Excited to welcome Tony Irons to the Basketball Podcast. Currently, Coach Irons is the head men's basketball coach at Mineral Area College. Irons completed a historic 2025-26 campaign in just his second year, sweeping the regular season conference, regional 16, and Midwest District Championships. His immediate impact earned him both Region 16 and Midwest District Coach of the Year honors, culminating in a high-stakes national tournament appearance. This collegiate success follows an unprecedented run at Vashon High School, where Irons amassed a 216-38 record and captured seven Missouri High School state championships, including a dominant streak of four consecutive titles from 2021 to 2024. Beyond the scholastic season, Irons has mastered the ultra-competitive grassroots circuit, serving as the head coach for the Bradley Beal Elite 17U squad in the Nike EYBL. In 2025, he reached the summit of youth basketball by leading his team to the Peach Jam Championship and was honored as the EYBL Coach of the Year. In addition to his high school and JUCO success, Irons brings a wealth of experience with USA Basketball, where he has served as a court coach and assistant for junior national team cycles. Hey, Coach, brief interruption from your podcast to hear from one of our top supporters, Hoopsalytics. Is your starting lineup not performing to your expectations? What if your star player is injured? Who should you play together instead? You can answer questions like this using the powerful Hoopsalytic basketball platform to reveal your most productive players and lineups. Just ask the AI assistant, and based on extensive player and lineup stats and analytics, you'll get accurate, data-driven answers instantly. You can literally ask anything about teams and players and then start making even better strategic decisions. Hoopsalytics also provides top-tier video link stats with a 12-hour turnaround time, as well as handy visualizations, interactive shot charts, coaching stats, easy-to-create film sessions, and lots more. And unlike the alternatives, you get unlimited video storage with no hidden fees. Best of all, Hoopsalytics is more affordable. Now in year seven, Hoopsalytics is a true game changer for thousands of basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball and start using advanced stats and AI to win more games today. Coach Irons, welcome to the Basketball Podcast.
Man, I appreciate you having me on.
Hey, I got a chance to know you over the last year or so. I watch you coach, watch you work in different settings. Always impressed with your approach and your methods and the way you do it. So we're going to dive deep into that. But let's start first with, man, few people have coached the variable levels you've coached and understood development from all those different perspectives, from high school to elite grassroots to junior college, all those different things. So maybe talk about that perspective that you come from.
Yeah, I played college basketball at an NAIA level at College of the Ozarks. I was fortunate to work for one of my mentors, and Steve Shepard, who just recently retired. After I got done playing, I ended up staying on as a GA for a couple years there and really found a love for coaching. Just really wanted to stay around the game and be able to impact young men like myself to give them opportunities to be around the game. I ended up taking a high school job shortly after that. And I was fortunate to coach at three different high schools for a period of about 15 years. And then made the transition to go to the junior college level right now. And then I've been heavily involved, like you said, with grassroots, with Brad Beal Elite and EYBL, and just been excited to work with that as well. I mean, my coaching career, young coaching career, I would say, even though it's been over 15 years, is definitely taken me a lot of places and got me the opportunity to meet a lot of different people and connect with guys like you.
I know you've also gone down the rabbit hole of CLA a little bit and understanding that a little bit deeper, some of which you were clearly already using, and then some of it that you're like, it's shaping your philosophy a little bit more moving forward. So can you bring us in the door a little bit and give us some insights in terms of that process for you?
Yeah, I feel like that I was doing some constraint-led approaches. Like early on in my career, I just didn't know that's what it was called. I just
very
felt
common
like I was...
for a lot of coaches. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, so once I start doing some research on it and listening to going to some clinics and really reading upon it and all that, just really realizing how that impacts the real overall success of a basketball player, just allowing autonomy, allowing the opportunity for kids to be able to grow through mistakes, because I think that it has a lasting impression on them as a basketball player and is able to transcend regardless of the school that they're at or regardless of the level that they go to. As a coach, we all want our players to be better versions of themselves, but a lot of times we fall victim to wanting to script it and wanting to overcoach. And I think that's a common mistake. And that's the mistake that I made when I was a young coach as well, was trying to control everything that went on in the game instead of allowing our kids to be able to act instinctually and play with some freedom. Those are things that I'm trying to continue to improve on. I'm not perfect as well, but like I want to continue to make sure that my players are able to learn through their mistakes, have some freedom, and actually have fun with the game. A lot of the constraint-led approaches are things that improve decision making, allows them to actually have fun, where they're getting better at playing basketball instead of coming in knowing, oh man, we got to do the same eight drills that we've been doing for the last 3 years. Now it's okay, man, I'm looking forward to coming into practice, doing something new and learning and actually being able to see myself grow as a player.
Well, thanks for sharing that introspection. And as you're talking about it, it clearly suits your philosophy as well in terms of that, and makes coaching a lot of fun. Coaches are in transition often at this time of year. So maybe talk to coaches in general. You've gone through some of these transitions to different levels and different experiences. Like you wear one hat and then you're going right to EYBL season, for example, this year. So talk to us a little bit about those transitions and then some coaches that may be considering some of those moves, some of the things that have stood out to you.
Yeah, obviously each one has its own challenges to it. We're literally last week was the national tournament in JUCO, and then this week is the first practice for EYBL. So it's not really much downtime. And then I'm also still in the process of trying to get a lot of my players placed from my junior college to next to 4-year situations. One thing I guess I would say is you have to be organized more than anything else, because those times, it's a fluid time. They transition right into another. And it's been a long season, and then now you're talking about getting ready to go into another season. You have to also be able to find a balance and find time to spend with your family and to do some reflecting. That's one thing that I tried to do more so later in my career. Early on in my career, I was just all over the place and just trying to move on to the next thing. But now it's just being able to reflect on the positives, things that need to be improved, just from an individual standpoint. And then when you talk about trying to rebuild a team or to give your players, when you meet with them on exit meetings, to talk about some highs and lows and things that they can improve on as well. So you have to have some time to reflect, and then you also have to have some time to be able to transition into the next thing.
What are some of those organizational systems that have suited you?
One would be I try to the day after, I try to just remove myself completely from basketball. That's the first thing, is try not to think about the season. I spend time with my wife, spend time going to see my mother, because again, those are the people who are probably the most important people when you're talking about being a coach, because they have to make sacrifices and they also understand that your time is going to be consumed by a lot of other people as well. So I try to just spend a day with that, and then I try to the following day organize my thoughts. Just again, I journal a lot. I'll write things down to see what went well, and if there's something that I felt didn't go well, what ways could I improve those things. And then when I do the exact same thing when it comes to my players, I try to write 5 or 6 different bullet points on things that were highlights and things that may be needing improvement. So when I do meet with them on exit meetings, it's just not me rambling. It's things that are backed up by data, things that we've saw throughout the course, and things that we talked about throughout the course of the year too. So when you're saying organizing, I'm just really trying to make sure that I gather my thoughts before I go in, and then just because I want it to be meaningful and I also want it to be impactful.
I love that. And you referenced this briefly, is the problem nowadays is there's almost too much information. So organizing your thoughts initially is a big part of getting organized. So I love that perspective. And you mentioned some of these different teams that you've coached. Let's focus maybe first on JUCO, often considered in some way a waiting room for these players, right? Where they're there, not really because they want to be there, but making them feel like this is the most important point of their life, this is the most important experience, the present moment, all the different things is a key to the success at that level. So talk to us about that and helping them understand, just be present and good things will happen.
Absolutely. So it's always looked at as the segue to the next situation. And I try my hardest not to operate it as the JUCO. I want it to operate it as it's almost like a university to a degree. I want guys to come in and to understand that we're here, whether it's 6 months or whether it's 12 months, to be able to be as impactful for them and to build as many relationships with them as possible. So when guys come in, they're either typically under-recruited, or they may have some academic issues. They may have something that they feel like that maybe didn't go well. So we have to also change the way that JUCO was viewed, because instead of it being looked at as a stepping stone, I want them to look at it as an opportunity for growth. When I bring them in, we spend a lot of time talking about how we can individually make them better, how they can come in. And obviously, being a part of a team, you want to have success collectively. So how they can impact what we're trying to do at this level. And again, we just try to focus more so on them. It's been great for me. This is just my second year, so I'm still learning a lot with it. But when you look at the way the landscape of basketball is right now, I think everybody is almost transitioning like a JUCO, because you have the portal. Even in high school, you have a lot of these academies and prep schools, and you have guys that are going to those situations for a year or two as well. I think everybody is still trying to find their niche with it, and everybody's trying to find the best opportunity for them to be able to grow. JUCO is just a platform to be able to invest a lot of time. We get an opportunity to spend a lot of time with them because they're on campus, and we get a chance to build some real meaningful relationships.
I want to talk about the relationship piece, but maybe that other part first, which is junior college coaches. I've talked to many over the last few years. You're more prepared for this transient nature than anyone because you've experienced this for a very long time. But this also connects to EYBL in a sense that you have a very short time to put together a roster, to get this roster playing together and playing effectively. And I'm imagining those two things back and forth work very well together for you in terms of developing your players and developing your team.
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, in JUCO, we have more time to be able to practice and build relationships. And in AU, it comes really quickly. You have guys that are from nowadays, you have them from touching states. So you may have people that don't even live in your area who are coming in for a weekend to be able to practice. And then you're taking road trips with them to build relationships with them that way. So that's a little bit difficult, is trying to get a group of guys who have aspirations of playing at the highest level, who may not know each other, finding ways to get them to connect and bond and grow to have some success at that level. And with JUCO, again, you have guys a little bit longer, but it's still the same nature as far as, like you said, still transient, where they're coming in for a period of time and then they're on their way out. I was teasing with my players the other day, some of our sophomores that were just now starting to get it. And the hardest part about being a JUCO coach is right when they're starting to get it, it's time for them to leave. We're preparing them to be their best versions of themselves for someone else to a degree.
So at all levels of coaching, building relationships is important. You mentioned that already, the importance of that. But let's dive deeper. What are some practical ways that you do it when you get into an EYBL situation or a junior college situation? What are actually the ways that you're doing this?
What I want the relationships to be meaningful ones. I don't want it to just feel like that there's a transaction where they're coming in and they're just receiving some knowledge and then they're out the door. We want to really invest in them as people. And so we spend a lot of time really trying to get to know them, get to know their families. EYBL, you get an opportunity to really be like in a hotel lobby, talking with parents and getting to know them and getting to know their families. And because once the players feel like that you have a genuine interest in who they are as people, then they're more willing to buy into what you're talking about from a basketball standpoint. You're spending time with them off the floor, doing individual film sessions with them where they can be vulnerable and you can be vulnerable as well, showing them that you're human and that you make mistakes as well. Because we're all growing, we're all learning, and we're all trying to be the best versions of ourselves. Putting them in a space where they know that they can just be a person and not be treated as a player per se, like more so being individualized as a person. So that's what we try to do, is really hammer trying to get them to be the best versions of themselves, both on and off the floor.
How are you handling tough love coaching on the court? You're dealing with a lot of players in a lot of situations, a lot of goals, a lot of pressures externally as well. So, how are you coaching them and getting them best out of them?
I just try to be, again, it goes back, I'm probably going to say relationships a lot. But because again, if you don't have a relationship with someone, then that person's not going to take the feedback. And so, what I really want to do is always be somebody who's transparent and honest. I look at tough coaching as just being honest and having standards and having expectations for them, and also wanting to know what their expectations are. Because for the most part, if they want to be great players or if they want opportunities to play at a higher level, then the best thing that we can do is to be honest with them. So whenever they fall short of a standard, then it's my job to remind them that this is what they want to do. And so, like, anytime you can do that, it's not as much so being tough, it's more so just that's building the trust and getting them to understand that, hey, I care about you. I want you to get as high, reach as high as you want to reach. But if you're falling short of that, it's my job to make sure that you understand that you're falling short.
Of course, in that sense, that to make sense. And EYBL and JUCO players are often hunting scholarships, so they feel they need numbers to be seen. And talk to us about that, whether that's true or not, and then ways that you manage that.
Obviously, I think the hardest thing is there's, as a coach, you're going to let someone down from a basketball standpoint, especially when you have a ton of talented players. So what that means is that everybody's not going to get the playing time that they want. Everybody's not going to get the numbers that they want. But again, it goes back to the trust, understanding that if we have collective success, then individually you can have success. And you always want to be, I know it's cliche to say to be a star in your role, but that's really what it is, because the same places that a lot of our players want to go are with people who value winning and want people to come in and be able to impact winning. We all can have different opinions on what that looks like, but I really truly believe that obviously numbers are things that people kind of, those are the first things that people look at. But when people come to actually evaluate, they'll see the things that sometimes numbers hide. They see the people who are great teammates, who are leaders, who are guys that know how to connect others. Those are the things that we try to preach. And again, we don't want you to put a premium on individual statistics. We want you to be able to see how impactful you were to the outcome of a game. So it's more so process oriented than it is based on, centered around results.
How about managing their inner circle, which has become obviously an incredible art and science
Man,
nowadays?
that's an amazing question. Like right now, you're dealing with agents and you're dealing with different people who, and again, have their, I guess, an invested interest in the kid, whether that's good or bad. So what you try to do, again, is you obviously have to deal with them. You obviously have to be as transparent as possible and with your expectations. And you really want to spend a lot of time, again, with the individual kid. Not really more so talking against what, you know, the people who may be having an objective when they're talking. You really want to be able to let them know, hey, this is what I feel like I can do for you. And again, it's not saying that your agent can't do that for you. It's not saying that your uncle can't do that for you. This is what, you know, when you come to this organization or when you come. And so it's trying to find a balance because, again, we both want the same thing for the kid. And a lot of times it's the kid not understanding that because you want this for them, this is how it has to look. We all, it may look differently to both of us, but that's still something that I'm learning how to do is deal with third and fourth parties because I'm used to just dealing with parents and kids. But now in this landscape, you're dealing with agents and you're dealing with NIL agents or just like people, AU coaches like myself, high school coaches, just different people who have an input on the kid's future.
It's just gotten bigger and bigger, that inner circle for sure. And that's great advice there. And how about coaching the disappointed player? The player that came in with the expectation that they were going to play a bigger role. How do we deal with that player?
Yeah. So again, you have a responsibility for all of your players to, like I said, be honest with them and to be able to understand that, like, hey, that there's going to be a little bit of a letdown as well. You may not have played as much as you wanted this year. You may not have had the success that you wanted individually, but I try to work as hard for them as I do with the players that may have had the success. So it's important for me to be able to, especially with my JUCO now, is a kid that's my 12th man who has aspirations of going and playing at the next level. I'm going to be reaching out to coaches. I'm going to be setting up opportunities for him because I do feel like that players, if they, I think that they've learned a lot throughout the course of the year and that they can be somebody that can impact another program. So as long, most of our kids understand that we really care about them and we really want them to have success post this. And so now it's really about showing them that. And then we spend a lot of time individually trying to help them get better as well, too. So you may not be able to, you may not be playing as many minutes as you want, but there's still opportunities to play. And that it always centers around the work that they put in and how hungry they are to be able to get on the floor to help us.
Referenced already, you won the UIVL championship last year. You've had incredible success at the high school level, winning state. You just went to national tournament for junior college. Let's focus first on junior college. What did you learn from that experience of being at nationals this year? I watched some of the games, really good basketball, really good outstanding teams, and to a certain extent, just seeing whatever team was hot that day. I know that oversimplifies it sometimes, but there are some teams that went on incredible runs in the games that I watched. And talk to us about the experience and maybe some of the lessons you learned.
Yeah, so just speaking on the EYBL championship last summer, we had a lot of injuries, so we ended up only having seven players during that run. And that it was surreal because we got injured. We had a kid get injured at the end of May who didn't get an opportunity to go with us. And then one of the games that we played, I want to say it was right before our Elite Eight game, we actually played with six players. You have to have some resilient kids. You have to have kids that are able to handle adversity, and you have to continue to preach those things too. Because what we couldn't do was make excuses for it. We had to show them that we had enough to win. They had to believe that. And then you have to also have, from an organizational standpoint, an incredible group of people who understand that too. So our president, Tim Holloway, was really critical during that time period and making sure that we were able to recover and to go get cryotherapy and all of those things too. And then our assistant coaches spent a lot of time making sure that guys were taking care of their bodies, eating right. We were keeping them hydrated, all those things. So when you're talking about winning from an organizational standpoint, like, everybody had to accept the role and make sure that they were doing their role at the highest level. My job was to continue to make sure that we had game plans ready and that guys understood those things and that everybody from a role standpoint was executing their roles at the highest level. So I learned a lot from that, just again, not just approaching it from a head coaching standpoint, more so looking at it as like an organizational leader and trying to empower everyone to do their roles and make sure that everyone was able to take some ownership of our program and understanding that their role was a major contributor in the reason that we won.
That's great to hear. How about the junior college championships?
Yep, similar. We've obviously, at the junior college, with this just being my second year, it is important for like me to make sure that I'm being involved in the community and that I'm visible in the school, because we have a ton of support. Like, our various teams, our volleyball team, our baseball team, all of them come and support games. And so what we try to do is make sure our players and our coaches are going and supporting them as well. Our president has a vision for what he wants the program to look like. He supports us. Our AD supports us. So again, it's organizationally, there are a lot of contributing factors to the success. And then you talk about just wanting to recruit players who have a vision of wanting to be a part of something bigger than themselves, and they want to use this as an opportunity to continue to grow and to develop an opportunity to go on beyond this. So it's synonymous when you talk about the EYBL and JUCO. It's about getting good people and having good people around you and making sure that all of those people understand that they're really critical to the success that you can have.
Hey, coach, I'm excited to let you know that we just released a full 86-minute masterclass on how we developed youth players and teams in simple and easy to apply ways. These are the same methods that I used with local teams here in Los Angeles that have gone from getting beat by 30 to beating teams by 30. At Basketball Immersion, we coach kids for the long term, so they're still engaged, confident, and improving later in their basketball career. Not just winning games at 8, 9, and 10. When you join, you get access to a youth coaching masterclass that's transforming programs around the world, plus our full library of incredible ready-to-use resources and courses. This masterclass alone is worth the investment, and your players will thank you. Go to basketballimmersion.com/sales today to get started. How do you create a standard-based system of accountability, coach?
This is funny. I took this from Dennis Gates, where he says standards over feelings. That's the motto that we live by as well. We want to have standards. We don't want to have rules. And when we talk about standards, that's something that, again, those are expectations. I spend a lot of time with whatever team that I'm on, making sure that whatever the standards and the expectations are, that they're communicated, but they're also, I want it to be a collective buy-in from players as well. So I want players to help shape what the standard looks like. Now, obviously, if you come to Mineral Area or if you play with Brad Beal, like there's going to be certain standards that are going to already be in place because those are things that, that we live by. But I think the more that players feel like that they have a buy-in with it, then it's easy to hold them accountable for those things. So if you want to be a Division I basketball player, then there's certain things that come along with that, right? There's a certain level of dedication that you have to have. There's a certain level of energy and enthusiasm that you have to bring to practice. There's a certain way that you have to go about things. Like all of those things are things that we try to hold as standards in our program. So when a player misses a workout, or a player is late to a workout, or a player is not going as hard in a workout, then you have to constantly remind them that, hey, this is something that collectively we said we wanted for this program. This is something that you said you wanted as an individual player. And so that's an easy way to be able to hold them accountable again for falling short, because now they know that this is something that I also want. This is not something that is being forced on me. This is something that together we're trying to achieve.
So creating a competitive environment goes hand in hand with that. So talk to us, what does practice look like? How do you create that competitive environment?
Yeah, I always say I don't like to use the term winning and losing. I like to use the term winning and learning. So we talk about that all the time, making everything that we do competitive. Because again, like when you become a coach, you're really talking about preparing people for life. And the real world is competitive. We all are. If you're trying to get a job, somebody's going to get a job and somebody's not going to get a job, like when you're going for the same job. And so what you have to learn how to do is learn from some things that may not have attributed to you to getting the result that you wanted. So what we want to do is make everything competitive, where that way they can understand that even the smallest things that we do, they matter. And so again, you want to learn from those things. So what we'll do is we believe in even if it's a drill, like if it's a shell drill, then what we'll do is we'll make sure that one emphasis of the day may be communication or talking. So we'll have groups, and whoever talks the loudest or whoever's the most impactful in their communication wins. And that may have nothing to do with the actual drill itself, but it just may be a focus area on what we're trying to do. So that'll be competitive. If it's a shooting drill, that's competitive. If it's a defensive drill, then there's a winner or loser in that. So creating a competitive environment is more so in everything that we do, even academics. We'll highlight guys that are excelling in the classroom. And what that does subconsciously is it makes other guys look at it and say, hey man, like I need to get my stuff together. If I'm struggling, if I have a C in a class, I need to get my C up. So we try to individualize it too. So it would not just also be competing against each other, but we also want them to be able to compete against themselves too. You're competing against complacency. You're competing against, your habits. If you have poor habits, then every day we're going to challenge you to compete against yourself to make sure that your habits improve. Competitive environment is more so just about just, again, a standard of just trying to create excellence.
It's a great example of not just competitive in terms of win or loss, but you create competition, gave that example of communicating within a drill and being the best communicator competitively in that drill. That's a beautiful example. I saw you coach, particularly at Elite 100, where you ran some stations and you did some stuff there. To me, it struck me and aligned with me in the sense that you're very conceptual in your instruction. So talk to us about conceptual instruction.
Yeah, I guess it's a we talk about it all the time when we say that kids nowadays don't know how to play. Like that's probably the number one statement that is made by a lot of people who were former players or coaches, all of those things, because they have the opportunity to train more. They have an opportunity to focus on individual skills, and they may not do as much 5-on-5 and playing. So conceptually, we want to teach people how to play basketball. We don't want them to learn plays. We want them to be able to make reads and to be able to understand, what goes on in the game, be able to make decisions. So conceptually, we talk about putting pressure on the rim. That's one example. Being able to cut and how cutting opens up other opportunities for things to be able to create dominoes, to play advantage basketball. We'll implement drills that will teach spacing and to teach how to cut and when to cut and what you're looking for when you cut, and then what, you know, once you make a decision, what decision now comes after that decision. So we want to put them in situations where they're learning how to play, and again, learning through mistakes, because that also opens the door for them to make a lot of mistakes. And mistakes are good because those are things that now can simulate what you'll see in games. And to be able to, because again, when you get in the game, you're not going to be able to joystick it. You're going to have to rely on them to have freedom and to be able to recognize things and make plays.
How important is flexibility in this approach?
No, it's huge. So I'm not a huge believer in having a set system. I believe that systems are determined by personnel. Now, obviously, if as a college coach, like I'm able to recruit people that I may want or I may feel like can fit some things that I want to do. But when I was a high school coach, that was not as easy to do. Like we were going to have kids that came through. And so I would have to adjust maybe what I wanted to do based on what I had. And again, that does not mean like they don't learn how to play. That just means that we have to put them in the best situation possible to be able to have success. So you have to be flexible. You have to also understand that the things that you do, they may not work too. There may be some things that you may have an idea, hey, I want to do this. And then you get a group of kids that may be more talented than what you may have thought they were, or they may not be as talented. So you have to be flexible to be able to pivot as well. You have to know that if some things aren't working, then we need to make some changes. And those changes have to be the better for the betterment of the group. Being flexible is huge. You can't go in closed-minded, and you can't go in thinking that it's a cookie cutter answer and it's a one size fit all deal. Like you have to be able to adjust.
Big part of your success in high school, and I'm curious how much has changed over the years, was your smothering defense. Multiple state championships at different schools. Defense was a key. So talk to us a little bit about the defense and then how that philosophy has changed as you've moved into EYBL and junior college.
Yeah, like I'm a huge man-to-man guy. That's from my college coach. That's from coaches that I've studied. I'm a big Kelvin Sampson fan. I love Houston. I love Iowa State. I love guys that really get after it defensively, because I also think that defense is something that there's a passion behind it. You have to, like, obviously there's technique and there's footwork and there's schematics that have to go with it, right? But for the most part, it's a desire. It's a desire. It's a competitive nature to want to be able to impose your will on an opponent. And then I also think one of my deals was I wanted my kids to have a little bit of autonomy offensively. So I wanted defense to lead to offense. So I thought that when you get after people and you pressure the ball, it leads to transition opportunities. It leads to them being able to display some of their God-given abilities. And we want to play fast and we want to create more possessions. Being able to get after people defensively was a way that I felt like we can be the most impactful. And that didn't really matter what personnel I really had, because we can always structure that around the kids that we had. We can get them to understand and buy in on that end. And then it creates also a lot of unselfishness offensively too, because I don't really per se care who I do care who shoots it. I'm not gonna say I don't care who shoots it, but obviously it opens up more opportunities for them to be able to have more success offensively by taking some shots and even making some turnovers too, because then you just have to make up for it on the defensive end.
You referenced and talked about being flexible and being willing to pivot defensively. When you're teaching your defense, or how much of it is like, this is our base defense versus this is what we're doing in these situations and versus this type of player? How does it
Yeah,
work? How do you shape your defense?
that's a great question. I feel like, again, I feel like man-to-man is the heartbeat of all defenses. And I think if you really truly know how to guard from a man-to-man standpoint, where you should be position-wise, you know, what regardless whether you're trying to force it baseline, whether you're trying to, if you're a no middle team, if you're a gap team, if you're a denial team, like you can always tweak things if you have a basic understanding of philosophically what you should be doing defensively. And what we try to do is we will tweak things personnel wise, but again, I want my kids to be able to be instinctual defensively as well too. So I don't want to tell somebody on a scouting report it says this kid only goes right, but still basketball, he's still capable of going left. So you still have to be able and willing to adjust to that. But there are things that if someone's a knockdown shooter, then we'll shade more to them. If it's a primary ball handler, then that's somebody that we'll try to take away and force other people to make decisions. If it's a post and we're undersized, then we'll do some post doubling and things of that nature. But again, it all centers back around what our core beliefs are from a man-to-man standpoint.
With that, then take us through just basic. What are you doing in terms of install? Are you installing individual on the ball defense first, rotations? Where are we going from install to application?
Yep, so I'm old school with this, a big whole person. Obviously showing what we want, where you should be from a team defensive standpoint. And then we do a ton of individual one-on-one, making sure guys understand footwork and things of that nature. So we do a lot of live things too. A lot of full court one-on-one that we build it from there. We'll go one-on-one. We'll do a lot of two-on-two, a lot of small-sided games where they have to be in certain spots. But then again, you're going off instinct as well too. So when you're talking about rotations and all of those things are results of being in disadvantaged situations, like where it's a 4-on-3 and now we have to rotate to the ball and communicate and all those things. So we're doing a lot of those things. We're doing, again, from a whole standpoint, showing them where they're supposed to be, how each person should be moving, connected, being connected defensively. And then we'll break it down individually as well to be able to show them, like, okay, this is what, from an individual standpoint, tracing the basketball, being arms distance, being having a closed stance and not opening up a gate. Like all of those things to make sure that they can put those things in perspective. And then we do a whole lot of live.
What does a whole lot of live look like, Coach? I love that. What does that look
Yeah.
like?
Yeah. So again, one-on-one, small-sided games, 3-on-3, where they have to be in gaps and they have to stunt and they have to be able to close out on the ball and be able to contain it for multiple dribbles. We do a lot of disadvantaged things where I'm a big 4-on-3 person more so than I am a 5-on-4 person because I feel like 4-on-3 is a lot more challenging. But it also forces them to cover more ground and communicate more. So we do a lot of 4-on-3 things where it'll start off maybe a little scripted, and then it'll go right into a competitive live where you have to get multiple stops in a row, or it has to be a perfect possession where if one person doesn't talk, or one person doesn't close out correctly, or someone doesn't box out and pursue the rebound with two hands, then the possession doesn't count, and then we'll have them do it again. We're just trying to be, again, as impactful on that end as possible. Putting them in some situations where it's adversity and they have to overcome it and be a little bit resilient because fighting through fatigue, fighting through just, and again, making sure that they're trying to get past their habits because you have players who, when they get tired, they stop talking, or when they get tired, technique isn't what it's supposed to be. So just trying to get them to push past certain areas, certain barriers, and to be able to accomplish the goal.
So scripted to live is one of my foundational things to marry these two things, game based to you still want to do your drill or whatever the situation you want to do. So talk to us a little bit more about some of the ways that you script, and let's stay within 4-on-3 since you love it a little bit. What are some ways that you script and then obviously go to live? Because I think this is so important for coaches to understand about how to be able to shape things within a game based approach.
Yeah, absolutely. So when you're talking about scripting it, obviously that's in an ideal situation where, okay, this is how we're going to get through this ball screen, right? And so if it's a ball screen defensive drill, and again, it's 4-on-3, and we're talking about the person who's guarding the ball, the person who is potentially guarding the screener, and then someone who now has to either tag or make a rotation, right? And then now you're playing out of that. What we'll do is we'll show you the technique. Okay, realistically, this is how we want you to get over the top of the screen. This is how we want you to hedge the screen. This is how we want this person to see if this person slips to be there to tag it, or if it's passed to the other guard spot, how you rotate, and then how the person who is guarding the roller, how he may rotate to the next pass. So we'll show that. And then we'll directly go right into where it's live. And then if they aren't able to do the technique that we scripted, then we'll break it down and ask them, okay, what kept you from being able to do this? Why weren't you able to get your inside foot over the top of that screen? So now you allow them to be able to communicate things that they're seeing. And then you can go into, okay, so now if this isn't the way that you're able to do this becomes another way that you can do this. So now they're able to grow from that standpoint, if that makes sense.
Absolutely makes sense. And again, foundationally, it's creating a system, a little bit of a structure, so to speak. And then from there, it can become unstructured, which is okay. And that's what you've referenced already about being willing to adapt, willing to pivot, and not make it's got to be done my way or it's wrong. It's like there's a lot of
Exactly.
different ways to be able to shape it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the game, right? Like we all, how many times have we been in a game and we've had this masterful plan and then it goes awry, right? And then now the plan has to change. So, your kids have to understand that, yeah, this is the way we may want something to occur, but it's not going to occur that way all the time. And you have to be willing to adjust. And as long as they're able to play through things, even through their mistakes, even if it doesn't look as perfect as we want it to look, there are still ways to have success in that. And I think that improves learning overall as well.
Love that. And you've coached obviously traditional high school. You've coached variable levels of prep and EYBL type players. So, talk to us about some of the development trends that you've seen, say, over the last 10 years in particular, that have been really positive, where you feel that players in this space doing these things, it'll help them accelerate their development more.
Yeah, I think so. From being from a traditional high school, and I think that's changed as well. But the
What is a
hardest part,
traditional high school nowadays is a great question.
exactly, yeah, it's not right. Like, there's no such thing as that right now. But what one thing that I had to adjust to was having kids for 4 years and seeing them progress from their freshman year all the way to their senior year. And nowadays, again, now I'm at the junior college level where I may have a kid for 6 months. And now you're talking about at the high school level, there may be with kids transferring and all of those things too. Like, realistically, you're not going to potentially have kids for 4 years. So what you have to do is figure out how to expedite the learning curve. There's a lot of information, and you spoke on it earlier about you don't want to give them too much information because then it becomes an overload. But at the same time, I think you have to focus in on specific details. I'm a big believer when you're talking about skill development or just developing as a basketball player in general. I think you have to do a lot with the psychological aspect of it because the skill aspect of it, those things directly are related to how that person is and how what their approach is like coming into practice or coming into a drill and all of those things. So you have to get them to understand that the atmosphere, the environment, their ability to bring energy, all those things are going to impact the repetitions that they give. So every day is just creating a standard of making sure that it's a high-level situation and then making them get up to the level of the environment. That's one thing that we try to do is make sure that, that we hammer home, all right, practice is getting ready, like from the beginning, if it's warm-ups, if it's agilities, it has to be high energy. It has to be a level of an expectation there for what that's supposed to look like. And then every drill has to transition into that as well. So we don't walk when we transition, we jog, we run, we move into transitions as well to the next drill and all those things, because those things I think are creating habits that will be able to stay with them when they transition from one situation to the next.
You referenced Dennis Gate, so I'm curious, obviously a lot of time in Missouri for you too. I'm curious some of your takeaways from some of his presentations and some of the things that he shared with us, maybe that we can share with coaches.
Yeah, he's a savant when it comes to basketball. He's highly intelligent. He's a great communicator. And one of the main things that I gathered from him is that his players genuinely have an affection for him. They love playing for him. I have a player that I coached in high school and also coached with Brad Beal that is playing for him now that loves him dearly. And that was part of the reason that he went to Mizzou was because he felt like that Dennis was going to really build a relationship with him, and it was not just going to be centered around basketball. That's the first thing that stands out when you listen to him talk, is how he cares about his staff, how he cares about his players and everybody that's in his organization. And then also his ability to help each one of them, meaning whether it's a coach, whether it's a player, a level of ownership within his program. He has his offensive coordinators are guys that he allows autonomy to create what their offensive system looks like. The defensive coordinator the same way. Their players are individually, or they're giving specific roles and jobs. Well, this person is responsible for, I think he called it like one person was responsible for creating energy, or one person was responsible for being the person to talk through, lead the charge on talking through a defensive assignment. Or so they each got individual responsibilities throughout their practices, which also keeps them focused, but also lets them know that they're important to the overall fabric of what he's trying to do.
Of course, another huge influence on your life is your dad, and your dad is a coach in particular. So share a little bit of that. There's a lot of father sons out there in coaching, and you've had quite the experience, and you've both been incredibly successful. Just a tremendous legacy.
Yeah, nah, I love him dearly. He had an opportunity to, I guess what's mostly the most surreal about it is I remember being a kid and going to his practices and sitting on his bench at games and watching him have an impact on a lot of young people's lives. And then now for it to come full circle where he has an opportunity to watch me in this role and he comes to my games. He was at the national tournament with me. He was at Peach Jam watching. So he's getting an opportunity to see it come full circle. I teased him the other day. He coached in the Jordan Brand Classic when I was a junior in high school. And he took me to Washington, D.C. And I got an opportunity to watch him coach in that and to see that. And then now to come full circle, I'm coaching in the Jordan Brand Classic this summer. And I'm taking him with me. So it's surreal to see it from that standpoint. So I've learned a lot from him, whether I and wanted to learn it from him or not. Like I learned a lot from him. And I've used a lot of things that made him successful. Like he always told me to take everything that he did that was good and leave everything that he did that was bad, right? I try to
Seems
live by that.
simple.
Yeah, simple rule, right? I try to live by that. And but again, I use a lot of his philosophies. I allow him to talk to my players a lot to share wisdom because, again, he's done it for 33 years and I've only done it for 16 years. There's a lot to steal. I still pick his brain and he still gives me his opinion whether I want his opinion or not.
That sounds very common for that type of
Yeah.
relationship. That's just
Yeah.
tremendous. Tony, man, so much good stuff you shared. And look, I love the perspective. I get asked all the time a little bit about having coaches on that have coached at variable levels, especially for high school coaches to be able to relate to the information. And I don't think there's anyone more relatable than you in terms of that and some of the logic and common sense that you approach your coaching with. So thank you so much for sharing the game with us.
Man, I really appreciate you having me on to talk basketball. I'm a huge fan of you. I'm a huge fan of your platform. I believe in everything that you do. And I just to be able to share some information. Again, I'm no expert. I'm just somebody who's passionate about the game and a lifelong learner and want to continue to learn. So any way that I can help in the future, any way that I can help coaches in the future, I'm more than willing to. You got my number, and I'm a phone call away, man.
And now all the coaches will contact you. So it's perfect as well. Continue to grow, continue to develop, and continue to share. You're awesome. Thanks, Tony.
All right, thank you.